are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 60, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. This is Tom Harrison, Chicago, Illinois. Welcome along to the show. So as promised a few episodes ago, we're going to take some time and look a little bit at the Norse god Tyr. Now, Tyr is a really interesting character in Norse mythology, not least because he's one of those characters that seems like he should be more important than he is. And what I mean by that is that Tyr is the god of war. However, in the Aesir pantheon, pretty much all of the gods are gods of war in some way or another. And scholars have often speculated that perhaps Tyr was a deity who had previously had a lot more importance in the pantheon than he does today. There's speculation that Tyr was, in fact, at one point, the king of the gods himself. So he would have been supplanted by Odin later on. Now, Odin has a very similar role to Tyr in that Odin is also a war god. And linguists have pointed out that the name Tyr, quite literally, in some of these Indo-European dialects, means god. This connection, even in the later Norse mythology, is still implicit, as one of the names of Odin is Hangatyr, which means the hanged god. Tyr is a common deity in the various Proto-Germanic religions. His names include Tuaz, Tews, and Tzu. In the writings of the Roman general Tacitus, Tyr is equated both with the god Mars, the Roman god of war, and also with the god Mercury, the idea being that Tyr was responsible for the distribution of spoils after a battle. In a funny way, the Romans are responsible for us still knowing the name of Tyr today, as they named the second day of the week after him, hence the word Tuesday. Unfortunately, Tyr doesn't have a very prominent role in Norse mythology. His biggest mention in the mythology, of course, is what I talked about back in episode number 54, the Binding of Fenrir. This is the story of how Tyr helped the gods bind this very dangerous child of Loki, and in the process, Tyr loses his hand. This loss of a hand also gives him another common link with the god Odin. Tyr gave up his hand in order to help the gods capture the very dangerous wolf Fenrir, while Odin, on the other hand, plucked his own eye out to gain wisdom, and by definition, to help all of the gods as a result. The commonality goes a little bit further in the fact that sometimes in the Eddas, Tyr is referred to as the son of Odin. This is carried on into the Marvel Comics, where Tyr is one of Odin's children. His first appearance is in Journey into Mystery number 85, though we really only see the back of his head, and it's far from clear of which of the god characters he is. When Marvel finally got around to introducing Tyr in the comic properly, they cast him as an antagonist to Thor, generally striving to compete with Thor for the affections of Lady Sif, and is generally just kind of a bad guy, being the evil, warlike Tyr fighting against the good and noble, warlike Thor. But as time goes on, as many of the other Asgardians' character under Simonson, Tyr has become more rehabilitated and has, of course, cooperated with the gods against Surtur and in other storylines as well. So, you know, Tyr's not strictly a bad guy in the Marvel Universe. It just kind of works for his own ends. Now, over at DC Comics, there's also a character who is inspired by the Norse god Tyr, and this is a red-skinned alien from the 31st century, first appeared in Superboy number 197 from way back in 1973. This Tyr was originally designed by artist Dave Cockrum, and came from a war world known as Tyraz. Tyr's warlike nature, of course, brought him in conflict with the Legion of Superheroes. Tyr had a kind of a funky 70 design with a big old mohawk, and his right hand was a detachable gun, which apparently was able to control other people, including Superboy. So even though there really isn't a lot of similarity between the Asgardian Tyr and this 31st century alien named Tyr, you can see that there's a clear inspiration going on here back to the original Norse myth. The DC Comics version of Tyr was never a particularly important character in the overall DC cosmos. However, it is interesting to note that Tyr was given his own action figures on a number of occasions, considering the fact that he's a villain that really hasn't appeared that many times. As much as I hate to say it, I don't think the reason for Tyr's popularity among toy makers has much to do with the character himself, but with the very striking design of Dave Cockrum. All right, so I hope you've enjoyed our little discussion of Tyr, and we do have a couple of issues to cover, so let's get on with our reviews.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
And we start off this week with what is billed on the cover as possibly the most unusual Thor story ever published. And that is the Mighty Thor number 364. It has a cover date of February of 1986. Retail for 75 cents. Cover art is by Walt Simonson. And we have a beautiful Walt Simonson cover showing Thor transforming into a frog. Yes, as we saw at the end of last issue, Loki had cast some sort of long-distance spell on this ironing woman, who then proceeded to find Thor in a dark alley and give him a big old smooch, and changed him into an amphibian. And we open up to the splash page where we have the credits. Walt Simonson was the writer and artist on the story. John Workman Jr. did the lettering. Paul Becton did the coloring. Ralph Macchio was the editor. And Jim Shooter was the editor-in-chief. And we have the title of the story, Thor Croaks. And we open up in Asgard and the gathering of the mighty Althing, where the Asgardians are gathered to pick the next ruler, since Odin's kind of fallen down the hole. And Frigga is standing up on the stage in front of the assembled Asgardian ranks, and she's holding Odin's scepter, which is glowing godlily. Godlily? Is that a word? I don't know. Anyway, so Heimdall's like, "Let all now be silent. Frigga, wife of Odin and keeper of the scepter of power, speaks."
"I charge thee, bearers of our country's banner, to ride throughout the kingdom and summon our people to the great Althing. One fortnight hence shall it be held here in the city. At that time a new ruler of the Golden Realm will be chosen, and Asgard may never be the same again. Bold warriors, ride forth to the four corners of the kingdom, and may the light of Odin's scepter shine upon thee and keep thee safe."
And the scepter glows and shoots off like little magic bolts, and everyone goes riding off, dashing off on their horseback with a giant thru-boom as everyone gallops away looking. I guess they're going to gather everyone here, and then they vote on who's going to be their next king. And then they cut back to where Frigga and the others are, and we see Heimdall and Sif and the Warriors Three, and they're standing on the stage discussing what just went on, and Frigga's like,
"I never dreamed I should see the day when a hand other than my husband's would hold his radiant scepter."
Oh my. Heimdall is concerned, and she's,
"I'm all right, Heimdall, but just when you think you've lived so long there's nothing new under the sun, the fates conspired to show you something beyond your wildest imaginings. And who would have believed I should dwell in my house alone?"
And Fandral is saying that he will guide her back to her hall, but he's wondering where Thor is. Thor really should be the one who's doing this. And everyone's kind of wondering where he is. And they're postulating that maybe he got caught in a cosmic storm between Midgard and Asgard. They suddenly see a vortex come in with a giant varum. It's kind of like one of those Ajax White tornadoes that Thor likes to use to teleport. And they're like, "Hey, wait, maybe this is Thor now." And it's not Thor, but it is Beta Ray Bill. And so everyone's like, "Oh, hey, it's Beta Ray Bill." And Sif is particularly glad to see him, says, "Oh, Beta Ray Bill, you've come to Asgard." And he's like, "Thor has extended your invitation, Lady Sif, and I told him I would accept it. And now that I am here, I must thank him as well."
"But did he not come with you?"
"No, he left Earth sometime before with his chariot. He knew there was much to be done here and was in a hurry to return home." "You mean he's not arrived?"
And they kind of explain, you know, they thought maybe the storm slowed him down, but Beta Ray Bill's like, "Well, yeah, there's storms, but, you know, they're not as bad as all that. They shouldn't have slowed down Thor." So they're rethinking now that something horrible may have happened to the God of Thunder. And we then cut back to Earth, and we see that something horrible has indeed happened to the God of Thunder. And he's sitting there in the alleyway going, "Ribbit, ribbit," which, of course, translated says, "A frog. I've become a frog." And they now, you know, say that they're translating from the frog, so you can understand what Thor is saying. And he reckons that only Loki would have the knowledge and will to achieve this transformation. But even he lacks the power to effect such a change at this distance. And he realizes that if this was Loki, then he has somehow gotten much more powerful than he was before. So Thor goes hopping off away from his goats and his chariot out into the streets. And he's making his way to Avengers Mansion because he figures, well, if anybody can help him, it'll be the Avengers. And so he decides to get in the mansion and manages to leap through the window with one bound. Because, you know, what's interesting about being a frog and Thor is that he was transformed wearing his magic belt. So he's actually much, much stronger than your average frog. And he leaps through the window into the kitchen because that's, you know, he's used to going in through the window, as we know from the earlier issues of Thor. And he jumps into the kitchen and he knocks over a container of sugar and he reasons that he's going to write a message in the spilled sugar on the floor. And he starts beginning to write, "Help, I'm Thor." And Jarvis and Franklin come wandering into the kitchen. Franklin, of course, being Franklin Richards, who we saw briefly last issue. And he's being babysat by Jarvis, apparently, while the Fantastic Four are off having their own adventures. And Franklin is like, "I heard it too, Jarvis. Look, it's a big frog."
"Stand back, Master Franklin. There's no telling what sort of fiendish device the Avengers' enemies may have sent us disguised as a frog. It may even be one of the villains himself in costume. And the Avengers are all away at present. Fortunately, I believe I can deal with this intruder myself."
And Franklin notices that there's something weird about the sugar spilled on the floor. And Jarvis has already noticed it. He says,
"Sugar! This fellow must have a sweet tooth. Open the pantry door, please, Master Franklin."
And Jarvis sweeps through the message with a broom and is sweeping the sugar out the door, along with Thor the frog himself. And he's saying, "The Avengers Mansion is no place for the likes of you." And Franklin's like,
"But Jarvis, he wrote something in the sugar. I saw it, letters and everything."
"And can you tell me how on earth you think a frog learned to write? I think, Master Franklin, that perhaps we should restrict our intake of Saturday morning cartoon shows more severely."
"No, really, Jarvis."
"And Master Franklin, kindly take your fingers out of your mouth and drop the rest of the sugar back on the floor where it belongs. Now, if you'll fetch the dustpan, please."
And Thor is trapped outside now, and he's out back by the garbage cans in Avengers Mansion alleyway. And we see a rat lurking up behind him. And Thor's kind of thinking, well, you know, that's so much for that. And he's got to wait for one of the Avengers to arrive, because Jarvis isn't about to let this frog in the house again. But he notices the rat sneaking up behind him, and he does a giant sprung out of the way. But of course, like Frogger, he has leaped into the middle of traffic. And somebody is driving in a taxi cab, and he's like, "Hey, buddy, did you see that? Looked like a bullfrog the size of Montana leaping into Central Park." And he's like, "Oh, no problem, cabbie. I'll get out right here." Thor is leaping around, and he ends up in Central Park. He's like, "Surely whoever penned 'Look Before You Leap' must have spent some time as a frog." Yeah, I don't know if Shakespeare spent any time as a frog, but hey. Naturally, rats would be interested in frogs' legs. Of course, yeah, why not? And he sees that the rat who was pursuing him in the alleyway is still chasing him and making his way across the busy New York street and chases him into Central Park. And Thor decides, well, hey, you know, I may be a frog, but I'm still Thor. And Thor doesn't run from his enemies. So he confronts the rat with a giant chug-a-roomp, you know, how frogs do. And his, like, throat bursts out the way, you know how a frog's throat expands when he's chug-a-rump. Rat is very surprised. He goes, "Squee!" And while the rat is stunned, he gets kicked and stomped and otherwise beat up by Thor in his frog form. And the rat runs away. And Thor says, in frog language, "Thus the foes of Thor are always vanquished. And when I am finished, Loki, you shall feel like a brother to that rat." We then cut to the alleyway, and we have a drunk stomping down the street, singing out of tune, and he's drinking his liquor out of a paper bag, and he comes face to face with Thor's goats, and he's very horrified by that. Goes running away, It's a cute little moment, but it's unimportant to the story. We then cut back to Central Park, where Thor Frog is jumping around, and he's saying to himself, "No frog should be able to do that to a rat. When I was transformed, I was wearing my magical belt of strength. Although my power has been diminished far below that of the God of Thunder, still I possess powers and abilities far beyond that of any mortal frog." And he's talking to himself, and he hears a voice. "Psst, pal, over here. Better get undercover fast. Southside will be coming back with some buddies any minute." And I guess Southside is that rat that he was fighting against. And he sees a smaller frog, and Thor's like, "Your words are wise, my friend." The smaller frog is like, "Brother, you sure cut him up. You must eat the right flies for breakfast." And asks his name, and he says, "My name is Thor." And the other frog is like, "Funny name for a frog. I'm Puddle Gulp. Where are you from?" And Thor explains he's from a long way off, and he's just passing through. And Puddle Gulp is like, "I can believe it. They don't make frogs like you around here, though I sure wish they did." And Thor's now curious about it. He's like, "Well, why is that?" And Puddle Gulp's like, "Well, there's a war going on. You really are from somewhere else, aren't you? Listen, if you're going to be around for a while, we sure could use you." And Thor's wondering who they're fighting. And he reveals that they're at war with the rats. And the rats have decided to try to destroy the frogs once and for all. So they're going around the Great Lawn in Central Park. And they're saying that it was some kind of big fireworks show. I wonder if they're talking about the big portal that went from Central Park to Asgard. Because that would be actually a cute little tie-in. And it looks, of course, like the Great Lawn is all ripped up, which would be consistent with the Asgardians camping there. As you recall, you know, they did after the battle with Searcher's demons. And so they're saying that some tunnels got opened up in the underground during a fireworks show, which I guess is the portal and all that. And a few frogs went down towards the smell of water, but they never came back. And he said there's some kind of dragons living below the ground. They don't come up to the surface very often, but they do kind of stay away from there. And he's even saying even the rats don't go down there anymore. But they figure that once they're beyond the trees, then they'll be more or less safe. We then cut back to Asgard. As you recall, the three children of Volstagg, including his daughter Hildi, have discovered the Sword of Surtur lying on the wilderness that borders Asgard. And there's some sort of a mechanical device attached to the sword, drawing energy from it. And the kids are like, "You're right, Hildi. That must be Surtur's sword lying right where he dropped it during his battle with Odin. And all that machinery is drawing power from it. We've got to tell Frigga and Heimdall right away. I wonder why Heimdall didn't see it." They start to leave, and one of the kids turns around and says, "Hildi, wait, look! The sword, it's gone!" And they turn around, and indeed, the sword looks as though it's gone. And it's like, "Did we dream it?" And Hildi's like, "No, look, right at the edges of where the sword was, things look wavy, like heat rising off a road. And when you step closer, you can see the sword again. The whole thing is surrounded with some kind of cloaking shield. Only one god would do something like that. Loki's up to no good, and nobody knows it but us. We've got to get to Heimdall and warn him." We then cut back to Earth and Central Park Reservoir, and Thor and Puddle Gulp are bouncing their way towards the reservoir. And Puddle Gulp is kind of explaining the lay of the land to Thor. And "We gather every evening near the gatehouse. Hopefully we'll..." What was that? It sounded like a hiss. And they see that there are rats kind of down by the water's edge. And they're fighting the king's bodyguards, Gullywump. And so they kind of bounce towards the king. And Puddle Gulp says, "Hold on, your majesty, I'm coming." And he wades into the battle. And Thor realizes the Puddle Gulp is outmatched by these rats. And, yeah, he realizes, you know, he's got to stick up for him because that's what he does. It's, you know, he's a hero. And the rats are like, "Ratso, look, another frog, a giant. He'll make a meal for all of us." And Thor says, "This frog, Ratso, will make the toughest meal that you ever tried to eat." And he wades in and he's kicking him around and the rats are going flying and he's going, you know, grump or whatever, however he did with his, you know, the big bullfrog throat thing. And the rats go running away. Thor's like, "Well, that's that." And say, "Puddle Gulp." And Puddle Gulp's like, I'm okay, Thor, but the rats got through the bodyguard and they've attacked the king, and the king is lying there, and it's like, "Puddle Gulp, is that you?" "Yes, sire. The rats were dragging an old garbage bag with rat poison in it into the water. We stopped them. Who's your friend?" "His name is Thor, King Glugwort. He is simply passing through.
No, he must not. He is the miracle I've prayed for. I didn't realize the frogs prayed, but okay. The gods would not mock us with such a fighter, only to take him away again. Surely he won't turn his back on his own kind. Thor, my kingdom, my daughter, take whatever you want, but save our people. Promise. And King Glugwort dies. And so Thor and Puddlegulp dive into the reservoir to go get help. And they emerge underground, or not really underground, but like underneath a dock or something is what it looks like. The other frogs are there. And the princess is like, have you seen my father? Princess, the king is dead. He is slain by our enemies. I'm sorry, Greensong. My father? Dead? And one of the other frogs, who looks a little bit less friendly than the rest, he goes, you're still alive, Puddlegulp. I would have given my life to save my lord. That's a pity you weren't there, Bug-Eye. And Thor's like, is there some problem? And Puddlegulp explains that Bug-Eye wants the princess for himself, and he wants to rule the kingdom. Puddlegulp is saying that he'll do neither as long as he's alive. And then Puddlegulp introduces Thor to the rest of the frogs, and he says, my fellow bullfrogs, meet Thor. He fought ferociously to save our king, but he and I were too late. With his dying breath, Glugwort charged that we do everything we could to persuade Thor to stay and help us, even if he had to give up the kingdom or the princess. Bug-Eye goes, what? Not a chance. Why, this Thor might even be some enemy in disguise working for the rats. And Thor's like, well, if I were Bug-Eye, I would have made sure that you were with the king's bodyguard today. You remind me too much of someone I already know. And at that moment, another frog emerges from the water, and he goes, Princess Puddlegulp, look, it's Dewlap. Listen up. I've just come from the lake on the other side near the great castle. I have no idea. I guess there's a castle in Central Park. I just don't know. The rats are collecting the rat poison that's been placed around the park, and they're planning to dump it all into the reservoir tonight. We're doomed! And Thor's thinking, well, poison in the reservoir could be a lot of trouble for Manhattan as well as for the frogs. I must return to Asgard as quickly as possible, yet the inhabitants of Manhattan, both human and animal, need my help. How shall I weigh the lives of those under my protection against a potential tyranny in my homeland? And Bug-Eye is just saying, you see him hesitate. This blowhard is no savior who would lead the frogs to victory. Drive him out, and we will save ourselves. And Thor's getting all intimidating over him, says, I think, little frog, you've said enough. Frogs of the reservoir, heed my words. I am a stranger here among you, and though I have listened to what has been said, no one has asked me what I want myself. Lives are precious to me, no matter how humble they may be, and if I can, I will save the lives of those who have shown me sanctuary. And Puddlegulp says, you're an okay frog, Thor, but what do you plan to do? I'm not sure, but I have an idea. Tell me again about the terrible dragons you spoke of. And I'm trying to explain it to him, and he's like, well, what's to tell? They exist, I'm sure of that. They devour rats or frogs with equal indifference. You said frogs had sought them out before. How? And he explains there's a hidden passage below the gatehouse. And so Thor's like coming up with a plan, and he decides he's going to go down, I guess, into the reservoir, and he dives in. And Bug-Eye is saying, I told you that frog wouldn't be any good to us. What can one frog do against the rats? And they're like, oh, shut up, Bug-Eye. And Thor comes out of the water on the shore of the lake, and he's saying, Bug-Eye may be correct. By themselves, the frogs will never be able to stand up to the rats. Everything depends on finding reinforcements. And Puddlegulp's story about dragons reminds me of certain rumors that have reached the Avengers from time to time. I may yet be able to find the right kind of allies, but I shall need the right kind of bait. And he is being approached by evil rats, and they're saying, look, it's that frog I was telling you about, and we outnumber him 10-1. And they go after Thor, but Thor's leaping around as his super frog self. We then cut back to Asgard as all the travelers from throughout the kingdom are pouring into the city of Asgard for the great All Thing to decide who will be their next ruler. And the Warriors Three are there, and they're saying, you know, hey, you know, the tall town is all full of people, and why not? There's never been an All Thing called before to decide on a matter of such importance. And they're wondering why Loki's been so quiet lately, and Hogan's like, perhaps he's already struck. No trace of Thor has been found. Do you think Loki would dare? Says Fandral. And we see Heimdall coming up the you know, through the door behind them, and he says, for the throne of Asgard, I think he will dare anything. Come, the opening session of the Althing is about to begin. Today Asgard chooses the lawgiver who shall govern this conclave, and for the first time in eternity it shall not be Odin. And we go to this giant arena-looking thing, and we see the pact, of course, with various gods and goddesses of Asgard. And Frigga's there, and she's holding Odin's scepter in her hand. He's like,
hosts of Asgard, welcome. I hold above me the great scepter of power. By its light you shall solemnize your decisions here. Let all men and women search their hearts and find the courage to speak only the truth within this amphitheater. I, Frigga, wife of Odin and mother of the gods, declare the great Althing of Asgard open.
And this giant mechanical device comes down from above. And this is, I think this is the first time we've seen, like, futuristic device. You know, Jack Kirby used to draw all sorts of fantastic devices in Asgard. But this is, I think this is the first time we've seen one from Simonson. And it grabs the scepter and rises up, and the scepter's glowing real bright, and energy's pouring off it.
And she says, now we shall hear the nominations for the office of lawgiver.
And Loki comes up to the stage, and he's saying,
my friends, Loki claims the right as Odin's stepson to stand before you now. Can there be any doubt as to who would best serve Asgard in her hour of need as the lawgiver of the Althing? Surely only Odin's trusted advisor and confidant, the Grand Thane, would stand in this assembly as lawgiver. Who else would honor the sacred trust or fulfill that office so well? Speak, Asgardians, and tell me you agree that no other could so faithfully execute these duties in this solemn hour.
And everyone cheers, and the great Thane stands forward and is to receive the office of lawgiver. And Heimdall confronts Loki, and Loki's like,
well met, Heimdall, why so doer? Do you not think the choice of Odin's old friend a wise one?
So it would seem, Loki, but you have been too quiet of late, and I am reminded of an ancient adage, when the voice of Loki is still, look to thy weapons, for surely there is menace in the air. I do not see your motives clearly yet, but that time will come.
And Loki goes off, and he's thinking, you suspect Heimdall, but you do not know. Perhaps the time has come for another frog to grace the Asgardian ponds. And Heimdall's kind of thinking to himself, he's convinced more than ever that Loki is somehow behind Thor's disappearance. He doesn't have any doubt that Loki is manipulating the Grand Thane, so he thinks that his plan must be very deep. And at that moment, three children come running in and saying, Heimdall, Uncle Heimdall! And he notices that they're scared and trembling.
We found the sword, but you can't see it, and Loki's already gotten to it. And besides,
she's trying to make them slow down and tell the story. And they explain to him that the sword is out in the wilderness. And Heimdall goes, he looks there, you know, with his supervision, but he doesn't see it. And she's saying,
that's right, it's invisible. It's Surtur's sword, and Loki's already found it.
But he notices that little bit of distortion, and he thinks, you know, there's something to this story. So he sends the three children to find the Warriors Three and to send them back to him. He's thinking to himself, Thor missing? Baldur gone, where even my sharp eyes cannot find him. Yeah, because this took place during the Baldur the Brave mini, and Baldur's off playing Shrinky Dinks in the land of Jotunheim. He's saying, something tells me that Loki has only just begun his plan of campaign. And we cut back to where the Grand Thane, he's saying,
citizens of Asgard, I call upon the sons of Odin to stand with me now before the Althing.
And Loki is there.
Loki is here, lawgiver, to answer the call of the Althing promptly.
Again, I summon the mighty Thor to take his place before the assembly.
And Thor doesn't appear, because he's off being a frog. And there's like, where's Thor? What do you suppose he's... Where is he? It's unbelievable he's not here. The Thane is saying,
for the third and final time, let Thor step forward or forever step aside.
And Loki's singing to himself,
hop forward is more like it, old man, but 'tis a long jump from Midgard to Asgard. And with the cloak of disruption drawn around his chariot and hammer, no Asgardian will find a trace of Thor until far too late.
And all of a sudden, Thor arrives. Interesting. He shows up and he's saying, I beg the Althing, forgive my tardiness, a pressing matter of business. Well met, brother. And Loki's like, Thor! Yeah, he's wondering what's going on, as are we. We then cut back to Earth and the sewer under New York City. And it looks like Thor Frog has beaten up a bunch of rats and he's dragging them around by their tails. It appears the rumors were correct. The opening in the gatehouse has led me to a series of interconnected tunnels that angle ever deeper down into the dark. And Puddle Gulp's tale of the dragons begins to make sense. Now 'tis time to leave another rat on the trail along my path before the park. So he's leaving a trail of rats. The light ahead of me is growing stronger. My destination must be just around that further corner. And he peeks around the corner and he's thinking, as I suspected, alligators. The fables of New York City are true. But is that some man I see seated before the great beasts, playing a tune as though he were serenading his lover beneath a balcony in the moonlight? And yeah, we recognize this character. He's appeared in various other comics in the Marvel Universe, but he's one of the Morlocks. And who they are, they're these mutants that live in the sewers below New York City. And I think they just call this guy the Piper. I don't actually remember, but he can control the alligators below New York City with his flute. And he notices the frog, and he says, huh, what's that moving over there? It's a frog. And there he's towing a bunch of rats behind him. And Thor is like, he's seen me. I better withdraw into the dark until I know more about this situation. But the Piper can control frogs with his flute as well, apparently. And he says, come back, little friend. I want to know what sort of frog hauls rats through the tunnels of an alley. Piper has the tune for you. Come back and let us get to know you better. And Thor is like, my limbs, I cannot command them. The music has taken control of my very body. Am I leaping into the light? Straight into the jaws of the alligators? And he goes bounding off into the alligators. And we have next issue's blurb. Guess who's coming to dinner? So what to say about this issue? You know, I've been really looking forward to doing the story, like I said last episode. And this is by far one of the best Walt Simonson Thor stories, in my opinion. And the reason why I say that is because it really takes talent to take an offbeat sort of idea like this, which is completely above and beyond most things that you're going to see in a superhero comic. I mean, this is just a weird concept. But somehow, Simonson has made this work. It's a combination of really tight plotting, really good dialogue, fantastic artwork throughout this issue. I can't even say. I mean, this is a great issue as far as all the elements coming together and just making the story work. At the same time, we have things progressing on Asgard, and we have the continuation of that normal storyline there amidst all of this offbeat stuff. Now, I have to say, you know, this Piper character I'm not real fond of. I was never a big fan of these Morlocks, and, you know, these are basically a group of mutants that lives in the sewers underneath New York City, and, of course, the idea of alligators in the sewers in New York has been around since the 1950s, but does anybody actually believe they're down there? Well, I wouldn't think so. Anyway, so that is really good stuff. So let's go ahead and move on to our next issue that we'll be covering this week. And the Mighty Thor number 146 has a cover date of November of 1967. Cover art is by Jack Kirby, inked by Vinnie Coletta. Shows Thor facing off against the villainous Ringmaster, who we saw last issue. And the cover blurb says, if the thunder be gone. And he's whirling his hammer around his head, and the Ringmaster looks like he's doing some kind of hand-waving thing in front of him. And we see one of the Gambinos, the acrobats behind him, and Princess Python there in the background, and one of her evil snakes approaching Thor from behind. We open up to the splash page where we have the credits. Stan the Man Lee, Jack King, Kirby are the writer and the artist. Vinnie Coletta was the inker, and lettering is by Artie Simek. And we open up the book with the Circus of Crime, and they're practicing their acts, basically. I mean, you have Thor, he's dressed in blue boxer briefs and looks like little footies, and he has this giant barbell that he's lifting over his head, and Princess Python is sitting on one side of it, and the two Gambinos are balancing themselves on the other side of it. I guess that would make it a little bit more challenging to balance this thing and lift it at the same time. And in the background, you see the Ringmaster approaching with a box. And it looks like the human cannonball is just kind of chilling in the barrel of the cannon looking on. And the Ringmaster is bearing a gift for Thor. So Thor puts down the barbell, and the Gambino's like,
He is every bit as strong as he claims it to be. If anyone can carry the golden bowl for us, he is the man. And Princess Python says, here comes the ringmaster. What do you have in that package you're carrying?
Ah, it's a costume for our new strongman. We might as well cash in on the fact that he looks like Mighty Thor. It'll be great at the box office. And Thor's like, a costume?
And he takes it out and he says, and he thinks, 'tis not but a cheap, gaudy imitation of my own regal raiment. And the ringmaster's like,
mighty impressive, eh? I had it specially made for you. The rubes in the audience will eat it up.
And Thor's thinking that all he has left is his natural strength and none of his godly powers. But, you know, he is actually Thor. And Princess Python is like, why don't you say something handsome? And he's like, well, there's nothing left to say. And she's hitting on him saying, I always did like the strong, silent type. And the ringmaster says, enough of that. Into your costume, Thor. The show is about to start. And the ringmaster's like, it was a stroke of genius deciding to call him Thor. Which, of course, as you recall, that was Thor's own idea. That had nothing to do with the ringmaster. But the ringmaster's more than happy to take the credit.
He certainly looks the part. And he doesn't suspect a thing. Okay, to work, all of you. I want you to keep rehearsing till I'm sure there's going to be no slip-ups.
And Princess Python is thinking, poor Thor, he knows less about what we've planned for him than my loyal Python does. And they're like, forget about Thor. The golden bowl is worth at least $20 million. Concentrate on that. And the Princess Python is, do not worry. When the time comes, Princess Python will do her part. Females and snakes. I don't trust any of them. That's the human cannonball. And they cut to a nearby tent where Thor has changed into the cheap, gaudy imitation of his costume, which looks, well, exactly like his costume. He's thinking how low he's fallen, that the mighty thunder god should be reduced to being a paid performer. And he's saying, yet no matter what a man may do, let him do it well, that he may deserve the name of man. So basically Thor is saying, if you're going to do a job, do it right. And he's going to perform as best he can. And next page, we have a full page spread here of the circus. And the circus is jam-packed with people. And it's like the big parade around the ring. And you have the ringmaster there, and the Gambinos, and the clown, and Princess Python. And she's riding like a chariot. And there's other performers as well. There's like this guy on horseback, and he's marching around. And there's a Wild West rider, a stilt walker guy. There's a chick with wings. So they're probably fake wings. And there's these very Asian looking elephants. I say Asian looking. They have slanty eyes. And there's a cart. The guy's driving some kind of a cart drawn by zebras, and there's camels and horses. And yeah, basically, it's your ordinary circus, though. It's an evil circus. And there's a guy selling peanuts. Get your peanuts! Get your peanuts! Yeah. And the ringmaster's thinking, look at them cheer. The fools, if only they knew. And the audience is like, hey, look, on the horse, it's Thor, just like the poster said. Mighty Thor wouldn't be acting in any two-bit circus. He's a phony. Who needs him?
Boo! Throw the bum out!
And the ringmaster's, quiet, quiet! He'll prove he's the real Thor. And Thor's thinking it displeases them that anyone would dare impersonate the true Thunder God. And the ringmaster set up this giant granite slab, and Thor whirls his hammer around and hurls it at the slab and destroys it with a mighty crack. The audience isn't buying it. They're saying, what does that prove? Anybody might have tossed that thing.
Hey, if it's the real Thor, why doesn't the hammer return to him?
And the ringmaster is saying, keep watching. It will return. And Thor's like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Odin removed the enchantment. But we see there's a glowing, spinning hypno disc thing coming down from the ceiling of the tent and spinning around. And all of a sudden, the entire audience is in a hypnotic trance. The ringmaster orders Thor to pick up his hammer, and he says that even though, you know, he's actually bending down to pick it up, the audience will see it flying back to his hand. And, of course, the audience is buying it now, and they start cheering, and, you know, like something really extraordinary happened. And Thor is mystified by that, because, you know, all he did was bend over and pick up his hammer.
And then Thor is taken aback by the fact that he spots a familiar face in the audience. And who should it be than our old friend, Jane Foster. And she's there with her date, who could be her boss, Dr. Kincaid, though. This guy's brown hair. So, well, you know, Jane Foster. It could be anybody. And it'll be somebody different tomorrow. Anyway, so Thor is like, no, by Asgard's golden gates, 'tis she. 'Tis Jane Foster, whom I did once love. But now my heart rejoices to see that she has found another. Oh, good, as long as she's not coming back. Odin, in his regal wisdom, has managed to ease the aching of her heart. Ah, would that the tribulations of mighty Thor be so easily brushed aside. And he goes backstage, and Princess Python is congratulating him and saying, you are real smash, Thor, but I feel foolish calling you Thor. How about leveling with me, handsome? What's your real name? And the ringmaster's like, hey, do you have time for that later? And Thor doesn't want to tell her his name anyway. And he's saying, the show has just ended, which means it's time for the real performance to begin.
Of what real performance do you speak?
Look into my eyes and you will learn.
And the hypno disc thing on his hat starts spinning around and he's hypnotizing Thor. He says,
your will is leaving you. Your will is becoming mine. The ringmaster alone can give you orders, and you must obey.
And Thor is hypnotized. He goes, I must obey. The ringmaster says,
it is done. He is completely under my control. Now let us begin.
And the clown's there, and he's riding a unicycle this time. He says, we're all ready. Nothing will stop us from getting the golden ball. And they then cut to the museum where the guards are guarding this thing. And the guards are like, I thought I heard a truck pulling up outside.
Me too. But why? It's too late for any deliveries.
We might as well go and check. It'll give us something to do anyhow. I feel like a nut standing around to guard something that an army couldn't manage to carry out of here.
Hey, who's that? And the clown emerges on his unicycle, and he's wearing a mask, which I guess is clowns do. And he's like, it's some kind of clown scooting around on a unicycle.
Hold it, mister. You're not going anywhere.
Don't take any bets on that, my friend.
And he's doing all these fancy unicycle riding tricks and riding up the stairs of the museum. And the guards are all confused by this. He's,
watch it. He handles that blasted thing like it's jet-propelled.
What's he doing here? He sure can't carry the bowl away on that thing.
He's probably just some kind of harmless crank. And then the Gambinos arrive, and they're doing their acrobatics and tumbling around and getting the cops to chase after them. And says,
good day, gentlemen. I trust that we're not too late for the festivities.
Ah, for the love of Pete, here's another costume nut.
No, there's two of them. What's going on here anyway? And chasing after the Gambinos, trying to get away. And it's just really a distraction for the human cannonball to catapult himself through a window. And they've decoyed the guards away, so they manage now to break into the museum. And the princess is sending her snake in, and she's climbing up her snake into the window, which must hurt the snake. But anyway, they're going sneaking in here, and the cannonball is like, I'll get the wall burned down in no time. Meanwhile, you let the others in. And there's guards in there, but they're wrapped up in the snake, and so they're set aside. And so the ringmaster then guides Thor in, and he's saying, follow me, strong man. We've done our share. Now the rest is up to you. And they approach the golden bowl. And basically, that is what it's described as. It's a great big, huge statue of a bowl made out of gold. And it looks a lot better than the lead statue that they had last issue. This one looks like it could actually be a work of art. Anyway, Princess Python is like, there it is. The great golden bowl is far lovelier, more spectacular than I ever dreamt it could be. It was found long ago by a team of explorers. No one knows its origin nor its age. But enough of that, Thor. Do what you have to.
I must obey.
And sends Thor up to lift the statue, and he gets below it and lifts. And he says, I must obey. And he manages to lift the statue off the pedestal and carries it down. And somebody comes bursting in the room. Ringmaster, you've got to speed it up. There's more guards heading this way. And they're really flabbergasted. Thor is actually carrying this golden bowl. And Princess Python's like, I've never seen anything like it. His strength is beyond belief. He's more like a god than a man. I wonder why that is.
The ringmaster's trying to rush Thor along, and he's walking in front of him, which probably isn't real smart. And he's like, "Faster, Thor, faster! From here on, every second counts."
And they're wondering why the human cannonball hasn't been able to burn through the wall yet. I would guess that it's because he's trying to burn through a brick wall with an acetylene torch. But he says, I'm getting there, and manages to get his great big chunk of the wall burned out. And he's burning through the wall that is made of stone. I mean, it's clearly made of stone. And even after he burns through the wall, and they have this giant magnet thing, which apparently is, they call it a hydraulic magnet, but it's a stone wall, so it shouldn't actually cling to it, you'd think. I'm not going to question it. it's comic book logic. Anyway, so this hydraulic magnet thing hauls a big piece of the wall out, and Thor's heading out with the bowl, and they bring it to the edge of the hole, and they're wrapping cables around it so they can transport it into their truck. And the guards, meanwhile, are in the corridor outside, and they're like, "I'm glad to see you, Sam. I thought that overgrown tapeworm would never let go." I guess he was wrapped up in the snake, and one of the guards is shooting to scare it, I guess, which I don't know if that would work on a snake. But anyway, it seems to. And they're wondering where the snake came from, and all of a sudden the snake is escaping down the air vent. And the guards are like, "Forget him. We got a lot more trouble. Somebody's after the golden bull. Quick, sound the alarm." And a whole bunch of guards come rushing in, and they're having a gun battle with the ringmaster and the human cannonball. The ringmaster manages to get some of the guards under his hypnotic control. How they can get the guards to watch his hat spin while they're having a gun battle, I don't know. That bit makes no sense. Anyway, so this is ongoing here. And it looks like Thor is managing to lift the golden bowl, get it out. But the sound of the gunfire is breaking Thor out of his hypnotic state, saying out loud, "Those shots, what's happening? What am I doing?" And there's the shots bouncing off this priceless piece of artwork. So I guess these guards don't care about damaging the golden bowl. And Thor drops the bowl, and he's like, "Why can't I remember?" And the ringmaster can't hypnotize him again because he's not looking at his hat. The ringmaster starts to panic, and he loses control of the guards as well. And it's just in the confusion, there's a lot going on here. And it's like, "Thor wasn't meant to snap out of it so soon." And the guards are like, "Look, it's Thor. That's how they managed to move the bowl. If he's turned crooked, we're in for it now." Thor realizes that he was under some kind of hypnotic spell, and the guards are mistaking him for a common criminal, though they're not really mistaking him because he actually did, carry the bull out to steal it. And the guards are ordering them to surrender. They're going to keep firing. When Thor dropped the bull, it manages to pin Princess Python to the wall, which is kind of weird because you would think that she would be crushed. If this thing were made of solid gold, I think Princess Python would pretty much be dead now. She'd be like jelly from the waist down. But maybe she has the power of super squishiness. I don't know. So then we cut back to Asgard, and we see the Rainbow Bridge stretching out towards Asgard. And to Baldur and Sif. And they're somewhere in the city, probably in Odin's palace, watching this big giant crystal prism thing, which is a kind of a cosmic voyeuroscope of the moment. And Sif says, "The God of Thunder is sorely in need of aid." And Baldur says, "Aye, but we are forbidden to fly to his side. In truth, I am sorely grieved, for the mighty Thor is like a brother to Baldur. Would we had not gazed into the enchanted prism. Perhaps 'twould be best not to know what doth occur." "Nay, he must not be now abandoned, not while Sif and Baldur live." "The heart of Baldur doth echo thy words, fair Sif, but we dare not defy the will of Imperial Odin."
"But although the Allfather is aggrieved with his warrior son, still is the Thunder God flesh of his flesh and blood of his blood."
And we then cut to Odin, who is kind of sulking out in the woods, and there's these weird root things that he's standing on. He's crackling with his red energy and pondering what to do. Thinking out loud here, "Though he be dearer to me than 1,000 worlds, 'tis I who am the father. 'Tis he who must ever be the dutiful son. Not even mighty Thor may be permitted the sin supreme, the sin of imperial disobedience." And to get a close-up of Odin's eyes looking really angry here, "Thus he be sentenced to earth,
and there shall he remain, stripped of all Asgardian power, till his penance be done.
And we then cut back to the museum, where the guards are surrounding them with their guns. And he's like, Thor, this is our last warning. Give yourself up, or we close in.
And we all know how powerful you are, so that means we'll come in shooting.
And Thor's thinking, if I submit to the ignominious capture, the God of Thunder shall be tried and sentenced like the basest criminal. Yet how can I battle those whom I'm sworn to protect?
And Princess Python is still being crushed by this bull. He's like, Thor, help me!
He's not yielding. We can't afford to wait any longer. And they start firing. Thor saying, I've dallied too long. The die is cast. And we have the next issue blurb. Next, The Wrath of Odin. And that is Thor number 146. Now, we do have a 5-page Inhuman story. And like I said, I'm not planning on covering those unless people really want to hear them. So anyway, pretty good story here. Again, I think this is probably the most effective use of the Ringmaster and the Circus of Crime ever. And it's kind of a shame because I think that, you know, more could have been done with those characters to make them, I guess, a true threat. At this point, even though they seem to be fairly effective in the way they're working, they're still pretty dull characters, and they really can't be taken too seriously. At the same time, it was 1967, and they're pretty good for 1967. Artwork, pretty good. Some of the inking is a little bit sketchy, but by and large, a pretty good job here by Vinnie Coletta on the inks. And of course, Jack Kirby does a fantastic job in this as far as the, you know, the hydraulic magnet thing and the interior of the museum. You know, they go into the museum and they have like mummy cases and plaques on the wall and fancy pillars. It's clear that he had actually been into like the Metropolitan Museum of Art and places like that, and kind of knew what they looked like. And so pretty cool stuff. All right, so that is it for this issue. So let's go ahead and wrap up the show for now. Thanks again very much for listening, folks. I really do appreciate it. Once again, if you want to email the show, please feel free to do so. The email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. I do love to hear from people, and I would love feedback, things to improve, things that maybe you think I should cover. So do very much like the feedback, and would love to hear from you. Anyway, this is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard.